This is a new recording of RD 8537. This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC 44325, The Caves of Steel by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1953-1954 by Isaac Asimov. Introduction copyright 1983 by Nightfall Incorporated. Read by Ken Kleban. This book contains 270 pages on 6 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress annotation. 1,000 years in the future, Earth's teeming billions are crowded into huge enclosed cities. New York City detective Elijah Bailey is forced to team up with an android to solve the murder of a prominent spacer from the outer worlds. Failure will jeopardize any hope of Earth's overcrowded population reaching out to the stars. 1954. From the book jacket. A millennium into the future, two advancements have altered the course of human history. The colonization of the galaxy and the creation of the positronic brain. Isaac Asimov's robot novels chronicle the unlikely partnership between a New York City detective and a humanoid robot who must learn to work together. The Caves of Steel. Like most people left behind on an overpopulated Earth, New York City police detective Elijah Bailey had little love for either the arrogant spacers or their robotic companions. But when a prominent spacer is murdered under mysterious circumstances, Bailey is ordered to the outer worlds to help track down the killer. The relationship between Lige and his spacer superiors, who distrusted all Earthmen, was strained from the start. Then he learned that they had assigned him a partner, R. Daniil Olivaw. Worst of all was that the R stood for robot, and his positronic partner was made in the image and likeness of the murder victim. About the author. Isaac Asimov was America's most prolific author, with more than 440 published books to his credit. His Foundation trilogy was given a special Hugo Award as Best All-Time Science Fiction Series. Foundation's Edge won a Hugo Award as Best Science Fiction Novel of 1982. And Dr. Asimov was presented the Science Fiction Writers of America Grand Master Award in 1988. Other Bantam books by Isaac Asimov. The Foundation novels, Prelude to Foundation, Foundation, Foundation and Empire, Second Foundation, Forward the Foundation. The robot novels, I, Robot, The Naked Sun, The Robots of Dawn. The Empire novels, The Currents of Space. Nemesis, The Gods Themselves, Fantastic Voyage. With Robert Silverberg, Nightfall, The Positronic Man. Contents. Introduction, Side 1. 1. Conversation with the Commissioner, Side 1. 2. Round trip on an expressway, Side 1. 3. Incident at a shoe counter, Side 1. 4. Introduction to a family, Side 1. 5. Analysis of a murder, Side 2. 6. Whispers in a bedroom, Side 2. 7. Excursion into Spacetown, Side 2. 8. Debate over a robot, Side 3. 9. Elucidation by a spacer, Side 3. 10. Afternoon of a plain clothes man, Side 3. 11. Escape along the strips, Side 4. 12. Words from an expert, Side 4. 13. Shift to the machine, Side 4. 14. Power of a name, Side 5. 15. Arrest of a conspirator, Side 5. 16. Questions concerning a motive, Side 5. 17. Conclusion of a project, Side 6. 18. End of an investigation, Side 6. Introduction. The story behind the robot novels. The writing side of my love affair with robots began on May 10th, 1939. But as a science fiction reader, it began earlier still. Robots were, after all, nothing new in science fiction, not even in 1939. Mechanical human beings are to be found in ancient and medieval myths and legends. And the word robot originally appeared in Karl Čapek's play, R.U.R., which was first staged in 1921 in Czechoslovakia, but was soon translated into many languages. R.U.R. stands for Rossum's Universal Robots. Rossum, an English industrialist, produced artificial human beings, designed to do the labor of the world and to free humanity for a life of creative leisure. The word robot is from a Czech word meaning compulsory labor. Though Rossum meant well, it didn't work out as he planned. The robots rebelled, and the human species was destroyed. It is perhaps not surprising that a technological advance, imagined in 1921, was seen as resulting in universal disaster. Remember that World War I, with its tanks, airplanes, and poison gas, had just ended, and it showed people the dark side of the Force, to use Star Wars terminology. R.U.R. added its somber view to that of the even more famous Frankenstein, in which the creation of another kind of artificial human being also ended in disaster, though on a more limited scale. Following these examples, it became very common in the 1920s and 1930s to picture robots as dangerous devices that invariably destroyed their creators. The moral was pointed out over and over again that there are some things man was not meant to know. Even as a youngster, though, I could not bring myself to believe that if knowledge presented danger, the solution was ignorance. To me, it always seemed that the solution had to be wisdom. You did not refuse to look at danger. Rather, you learned how to handle it safely. After all, this has been the human challenge since a certain group of primates became human in the first place. Any technological advance can be dangerous. Fire was dangerous from the start, and so, even more so, was speech. And both are still dangerous to this day. But human beings would not be human without them. At any rate, without quite knowing what dissatisfied me about the robot stories I read, I waited for something better. And I found it in the December 1938 issue of Astounding Science Fiction. That issue contained Helen O'Loy by Lester Del Rey, a story in which a robot was portrayed sympathetically. It was, I believe, only a second story, but I was a Del Rey fan forever after. Please, don't anybody tell him this. He must never know. At almost the same time, in the January 1939 issue of Amazing Stories, Eando Binder portrayed a sympathetic robot in I, Robot. This was much the poorer story of the two, but again I vibrated. Dimly, I began to feel that I wanted to write a story in which a robot would be portrayed lovingly. And on May 10th, 1939, I began such a story. The job took me 2 weeks, for in those days, it took me quite a while to write a story. I called it Robbie, and it was about a robot nursemaid who was loved by the child it cared for and feared by the child's mother. Fred Pohl, who was also 19 at the time, and who has matched me year for year ever since, was wiser than I, however. When he read it, he said that John Campbell, the all-powerful editor of Astounding, would not take it, because it was too much like Helen O'Loy. He was right. Campbell rejected it for that very reason. However, Fred became editor of a pair of new magazines soon after, and he took Robbie on March 25th, 1940. It appeared in the September 1940 issue of Super Science Stories, though its name was changed to Strange Playfellow. Fred had an awful habit of changing titles, almost always for the worse. The story has appeared many times since, but always under my own original title. I was in those days dissatisfied with any sale not made to Campbell, however, and so I tried another robot story after a while. I discussed the idea with Campbell first, though, to make sure he wouldn't reject it for anything other than inadequate writing. And then I wrote Reason, in which a robot got religion, so to speak. Campbell bought it on November 22, 1940, and it appeared in the April 1941 issue of his magazine. It was my third sale to him, and the first one he had taken as it stood, without requesting revision. I was so elated by this that I quickly wrote a third robot story about a mind-reading robot, which I called Liar, And this one Campbell also took, and it appeared in the May 1941 issue. I had two robot stories in two successive issues. After that, I did not intend to stop. I had a series going. I had more than that. On December 23rd, 1940, when I was discussing my idea for a mind-reading robot with Campbell, we found ourselves discussing the rules that govern the way in which a robot behaved. It seemed to me that robots were engineering devices with built-in safeguards, and so the two of us began giving verbal form to those safeguards. These became the three laws of robotics. I first worked out the final form of the three laws and used them explicitly in my fourth robot story, Runaround, which appeared in the March 1942 issue of Astounding. The three laws first appear on page 100 of that issue. I looked that up, because where they appear there is the very first use of the word robotics in the history of the world, as far as I know. I went on to write four more robot stories for Astounding in the 1940s. They were Catch That Rabbit, Escape, which Campbell called Paradoxical Escape, because 2 years before he had published a story with Escape as the title, Evidence, and The Evitable Conflict. These appeared in the February 1944, August 1945, September 1946, and June 1950 issues of Astounding. By 1950, important publishing houses, notably Doubleday and Company, were beginning to publish hardcover science fiction. In January 1950, Doubleday published my first book, the science fiction novel Pebble in the Sky, and I was hard at work on a second novel. It occurred to Fred Pohl, who was my agent for a brief period of that time, that perhaps a book could be made out of my robot stories. Doubleday was not interested in short story collections at the time, but a very small publishing house, Gnome Press, was. On June 8, 1950, the collection was handed to Gnome Press, and the title I gave it was Mind and Iron. The publisher shook his head. "Let's call it iRobot," he said. "We can't," I said. "Eando Binder wrote a short story with that title 10 years ago." "Who cares?" said the publisher, though that is a bowdlerized version of what he really said. And I allowed myself rather uneasily to be persuaded. iRobot was my second book, and it came out just before the end of 1950. The book contained my eight robot stories from Astounding, with their order rearranged to make a more logical progression. In addition, I included Robbie, my first story, because I liked it despite Campbell's rejection. I had written three other robot stories in the 1940s that Campbell had either rejected or never seen, but these were not in the direct path of progression of the stories, so I left them out. These, however, and other robot stories written in the decades since iRobot were included in later collections. All of them, without exception, appeared in The Complete Robot, published by Doubleday in 1982. iRobot did not make a big splash on publication, but it sold steadily, if slowly, year after year. Within 5 years, it had come out in an Armed Forces edition, in a cheaper hardcover edition, in a British edition, and in a German edition, my first foreign language appearance. In 1956, it was even published in a paperback edition by New American Library. The only trouble was that Gnome Press was just barely surviving, and it never did get around to giving me clear semi-annual statements, or much in the way of payments. That went for my three foundation books, which Gnome Press also published. In 1961, Doubleday became aware of the fact that Gnome Press was having trouble, and they arranged to take over iRobot and the Foundation books, too. From then on, all the books did much better. In fact, iRobot has remained in print ever since it was first published. That's 33 years now. In 1981, it was even sold to the movies, although no motion picture has yet been made. It has also appeared in 18 different foreign languages that I know of, including Russian and Hebrew. But I'm getting way ahead of the story. Let's go back to 1952, at which time iRobot was just plodding along as a Gnome Press book, and I had no hint of any real success. By that time, new top-notch science fiction magazines had come out, and the field was in one of its periodic booms. The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction appeared in 1949, and Galaxy Science Fiction in 1950. With that, John Campbell lost his monopoly of the field, and the golden age of the 1940s was over. I began to write for Horace Gold, the editor of Galaxy, and with some relief, too. For a period of 8 years, I'd written for Campbell exclusively, and I'd come to feel that I was a one-editor writer, and that if anything happened to Campbell, I would be through. My success in selling to Gold relieved my anxieties in this respect. Gold even serialized my second novel, The Stars Like Dust, although he changed its name to Tyran, which I considered awful. Nor was Gold my only new editor. I sold a robot story to Howard Brown, who edited Amazing during a brief period when it tried to be a quality magazine. The story entitled Satisfaction Guaranteed appeared in the April 1951 issue of that magazine. That was an exception, though. On the whole, I had no intention of writing further robot stories at that time. The appearance of iRobot seemed to have brought that portion of my literary career to its natural close, and I was moving on to other things. Gold, however, having published one serial by me, was perfectly willing to try another, especially since a new novel I had written, The Currents of Space, had been taken by Campbell for serialization. On April 19th, 1952, Gold and I were talking over the matter of a new novel that was to appear in Galaxy. He suggested a robot novel. I shook my head firmly. My robots had appeared only in short stories, and I was not at all sure that I could write a whole novel based on robots. "Sure you can," said Gold. "How about an overpopulated world in which robots are taking over human jobs?" "Too depressing," I said. "I'm not sure I want to handle a heavy sociological story." "Do it your way. You like mysteries? Put a murder in such a world and have a detective solve it with a robot partner. If the detective doesn't solve it, the robot will replace him." That struck fire. Campbell had often said that a science fiction mystery story was a contradiction in terms, that advances in technology could be used to get detectives out of their difficulties unfairly, and that the readers would therefore be cheated. I sat down to write a story that would be a classic mystery, and that would not cheat the reader, and yet would be a true science fiction story. The result was The Caves of Steel. It appeared in Galaxy as a three-part serial in the October, November, and December 1953 issues. And in 1954, it was published by Doubleday as my 11th book. There was no question but that The Caves of Steel was my most successful book to date. It sold better than any of my earlier books. It elicited nicer letters from readers. And, best proof of all, Doubleday smiled at me with greater warmth than ever before. Until that point, they wanted outlines and chapters from me before handing me contracts. But after that, I got my contracts on my mere statement that I was going to write another book. The Caves of Steel was so successful, in fact, that it was inevitable that I write a sequel. I would have started it at once, I think, if I had not just begun to write science popularizations and found I enjoyed doing that tremendously. It was not until October 1955 that I actually began The Naked Sun. Once begun, however, it went smoothly. In many ways, it balanced the earlier book. The Caves of Steel took place on Earth, a world of many human beings and few robots, while The Naked Sun took place on Solaria, a world of few human beings and many robots. What's more, although my books are generally devoid of romance, I actually introduced an understated love story into The Naked Sun. I was entirely satisfied with the sequel, and in my heart, thought it was even better than The Caves of Steel. But what was I to do with it? I had grown somewhat estranged from Campbell, who had taken up an odd bit of pseudoscience called Dianetics, and had managed to become interested in flying saucers, in psionics, and in various other questionable matters. On the other hand, I owed him a great deal, and I felt rather guilty over having largely shifted to Gold, who had had two of my serials in a row. But as he had nothing to do with the planning of The Naked Sun, I could dispose of it as I wished. I offered the novel to Campbell, therefore, and he took it at once. It appeared as a three-part serial in the October, November, and December 1956 issues of Astounding, and Campbell didn't change my title either. In 1957, it was published by Doubleday as my 20th book. It did just as well as The Caves of Steel, if not better, and Doubleday at once pointed out I couldn't leave it there. I would have to write a third book and make it a trilogy, just as my three foundation books made up a trilogy. I fully agreed. I had a rough idea of the plot of the third book, and I had a title. the bounds of infinity. In July 1958, the family was taking a three-week vacation in a house at the shore in Marshfield, Massachusetts, and it was my plan to get to work and do a sizable chunk of the new novel there. It was going to be set on Aurora, where the human-robot balance was to be neither overweighted in the direction of the human, as in the Caves of Steel, nor in the direction of the robot, as in the Naked Sun. What's more, the element of romance was to be much strengthened. I was all set, and yet something was wrong. I had grown steadily more interested in nonfiction in the 1950s, and for the first time, I started a novel which wouldn't catch fire. After four chapters, I faded out and gave up. I decided that in my heart I felt I couldn't handle the romance, couldn't balance the human-robot mixture in properly equal fashion. For 25 years, that was the way it remained. Neither the Caves of Steel nor the Naked Sun died or went out of print. They appeared together in the robot novels. They appeared with a group of short stories in The Rest of the Robots, and they appeared in various softcover editions. For 25 years, therefore, readers had them available to read and, I presume, enjoy. As a result, many wrote me to ask for a third novel. At conventions, they asked me directly. It became the most surefire request I was to receive, except the request for a fourth Foundation novel. And whenever I was asked if I intended to write a third robot novel, I always answered, "Yes, someday. So pray for a long life for me." Somehow, I felt I ought to, but as the years passed, I grew more and more certain that I couldn't handle it, and more sadly convinced that the third novel was never going to be written. And yet, in March of 1983, I presented Doubleday with a long-awaited third robot novel. It has no connection whatever with the ill-fated attempt of 1958, and its name is The Robots of Dawn. Doubleday published it in October of 1983. Isaac Asimov, New York City. 1. Conversation with the Commissioner. Lige Bailey had just reached his desk when he became aware of R. Sammy watching him expectantly. The dour lines of his long face hardened. "What do you want?" "The boss wants you, Lige. Right away. Soon as you come in." "All right." R. Sammy stood there blankly. Bailey said, "I said, all right, go away." R. Sammy turned on his heel and left to go about his duties. Bailey wondered irritably why those same duties couldn't be done by a man. He paused to examine the contents of his tobacco pouch and make a mental calculation. At two pipefuls a day, he could stretch it to next quarter day. Then he stepped out from behind his railing. He'd raided a railed corner 2 years ago and walked the length of the common room. Simpson looked up from a murk pool file as he passed. "Boss wants you, Lige." "I know. Our Sammy told me." A closely coated tape reeled out of the murk pool's vitals as the small instrument searched and analyzed its memory for the desired information stored in the tiny vibration pattern of the gleaming mercury surface within. "I'd kick R. Sammy's behind if I weren't afraid I'd break a leg," said Simpson. "I saw Vince Barrett the other day." "Oh?" "He was looking for his job back, or any job in the department. The poor kid's desperate. But what could I tell him? R. Sammy's doing his job, and that's all. The kid has to work a delivery tread on the yeast farms now. He was a bright boy, too. Everyone liked him." Bailey shrugged and said in a manner stiffer than he intended or felt, "It's a thing we're all living through." The boss raided a private office. It said, "Julius Enderby," on the clouded glass. Nice letters, carefully etched into the fabric of the glass. Underneath it said, "Commissioner of Police, City of New York." Bailey stepped in and said, "You want to see me, Commissioner?" Enderby looked up. He wore spectacles because his eyes were sensitive and couldn't take the usual contact lenses. It was only after one got used to the sight of them that one could take in the rest of the face, which was quite undistinguished. Bailey had a strong notion that the Commissioner valued his glasses for the personality they lent him, and suspected that his eyeballs weren't as sensitive as all that. The commissioner looked definitely nervous. He straightened his cuffs, leaned back, and said, too heartily, "Sit down, Lige, sit down." Bailey sat down stiffly and waited. Enderby said, "How's Jesse and the boy?" "Fine," said Bailey hollowly. "Just fine." "And your family?"
"Fine,"
echoed Enderby. "Just fine." It had been a false start. Bailey thought, something's wrong with his face. Aloud, he said, "Commissioner, I wish you wouldn't send our Sammy out after me."
"Well, you know how I feel about those things, Lige. But he's been put here, and I've got to use him for something."
"It's uncomfortable, Commissioner. He tells me you want me, and then he stands there. You know what I mean. I have to tell him to go, or he just keeps on standing there."
"Oh, that's my fault, Lige.
I gave him the message to deliver and forgot to tell him specifically to get back to his job when he was through." Bailey sighed. The fine wrinkles about his intensely brown eyes grew more pronounced. "Anyway, you wanted to see me."
"Yes, Lige,"
said the commissioner. "But not for anything easy." He stood up, turned away, and walked to the wall behind his desk. He touched an inconspicuous contact switch, and a section of the wall grew transparent. Bailey blinked at the unexpected insurge of grayish light. The commissioner smiled. "I had this arranged specially last year, Lige. I don't think I've showed it to you before. Come over here and take a look. In the old days, all rooms had things like this. They were called windows. Did you know that?" Bailey knew that very well, having viewed many historical novels. "I've heard of them," he said. "Come here." Bailey squirmed a bit, but did as he was told. There was something indecent about the exposure of the privacy of a room to the outside world. Sometimes the commissioner carried his affection of medievalism to a rather foolish extreme. Like his glasses, Bailey thought. That was it. That was what made him look wrong. Bailey said, "Pardon me, Commissioner, but you're wearing new glasses, aren't you?" The commissioner stared at him in mild surprise, took off his glasses, looked at them, and then at Bailey. Without his glasses, his round face seemed rounder, and his chin a trifle more pronounced. He looked vaguer, too, as his eyes failed to focus properly. He said, "Yes." He put his glasses back on his nose, then added, with real anger, "I broke my old ones 3 days ago. What with one thing or another, I wasn't able to replace them till this morning. Lige, those 3 days were hell." "On account of the glasses?" "And other things, too. I'm getting to that." He turned to the window, and so did Bailey. With mild shock, Bailey realized it was raining. For a minute, he was lost in the spectacle of water dropping from the sky, while the commissioner exuded a kind of pride, as though the phenomenon were a matter of his own arranging. "This is the third time this month I've watched it rain. Quite a sight, don't you think?" Against his will, Bailey had to admit to himself that it was impressive. In his 42 years, he had rarely seen rain, or any of the phenomena of nature, for that matter. He said, "It always seems a waste for all that water to come down on the city. It should restrict itself to the reservoirs." "Lige," said the commissioner, "you're a modernist. That's your trouble. In medieval times, people lived in the open. I don't mean on the farms only. I mean in the cities, too. Even in New York. When it rained, they didn't think of it as waste. They gloried in it. They lived close to nature. It's healthier, better. The troubles of modern life come from being divorced from nature. Read up on the coal century sometime." Bailey had. He had heard many people moaning about the invention of the atomic pile. He moaned about it himself when things went wrong or when he got tired. Moaning like that was a built-in facet of human nature. Back in the coal century, people moaned about the invention of the steam engine. In one of Shakespeare's plays, a character moaned about the invention of gunpowder. 1,000 years in the future, they'd be moaning about the invention of the positronic brain. The hell with it.
He said grimly, "Look, Julius, it wasn't his habit to get friendly with the commissioner during office hours, however many lodges the commissioner threw at him, but something special seemed called for here. Look, Julius, you're talking about everything except what I came in here for, and it's worrying me. What is it?" The commissioner said, "I'll get to it, Lige. Let me do it my way. It's trouble." "Sure. What isn't on this planet? More trouble with the R's?" "In a way, yes, Lige. I stand here and wonder how much more trouble the old world can take. When I put in this window, I wasn't just letting in the sky once in a while. I let in the city. I look at it, and I wonder what will become of it in another century." Bailey felt repelled by the other's sentimentality, but he found himself staring outward in fascination. Even dimmed by the weather, the city was a tremendous thing to see. The police department was in the upper levels of City Hall, and City Hall reached high. From the commissioner's window, the neighboring towers fell short, and the tops were visible. There were so many fingers groping upward. Their walls were blank, featureless. They were the outer shells of human hives. "In a way," said the commissioner, "I'm sorry it's raining. We can't see Spacetown." Bailey looked westward. But it was as the commissioner said. The horizon closed down. New York's towers grew misty and came to an end against blank whiteness. "I know what Spacetown is like," said Bailey. "I like the picture from here," said the commissioner. "It can just be made out in the gap between the two Brunswick sectors. Low domes spread out. It's the difference between us and the spacers. We reach high and crowd close. With them, each family has a dome for itself. One family, one house. And land between each dome. Have you ever spoken to any of the spacers, Lige?"
"A few times. About a month ago, I spoke to one right here on your intercom," Bailey said patiently. "Yes, I remember. But then I'm just getting philosophical. We and they. Different ways of life."
Bailey's stomach was beginning to constrict a little. The more devious the commissioner's approach, the deadlier, he thought, might be the conclusion. He said, "All right, but what's so surprising about it? You can't spread 8 billion people over the earth in little domes. They've got space on their world, so let them live their way." The commissioner walked to his chair and sat down. His eyes looked unblinkingly at Bailey, shrunken a bit by the concave lenses in his spectacles. He said, "Not everyone is that tolerant about differences in culture, either among us or among the spacers." "All right, so what?" "So 3 days ago, a spacer died." Now it was coming. The corners of Bailey's thin lips raised a trifle, but the effect upon his long, sad face was unnoticeable. He said, "Too bad. Something contagious, I hope? A virus, a cold, perhaps." The commissioner looked startled. "What are you talking about?" Bailey didn't care to explain. The precision with which the spacers had bred disease out of their societies was well known. The care with which they avoided, as far as possible, contact with disease-riddled Earthmen was even better known. But then sarcasm was lost on the commissioner. Bailey said, "I'm just talking. What did he die of?" He turned back to the window. The commissioner said, "He died of a missing chest. Someone had used a blaster on him." Bailey's back grew rigid. He said without turning, "What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about murder," said the commissioner softly. "You're a plainclothes man. You know what murder is."
And now Bailey turned.
"But a spacer? 3 days ago?"
"Yes."
"But who did it? How?"
"The spacers say it was an Earthman."
"It can't be."
"Why not?
You don't like the spacers.
I don't.
Who on earth does?
Someone didn't like them a little too much, that's all."
"Sure, but there was the fire at the Los Angeles factories."
There was the Berlin R-smashing. There were the riots in Shanghai.
All right.
It all points to rising discontent. Maybe to some sort of organization.
Bailey said, Commissioner, I don't get this. Are you testing me for some reason?
What?
The commissioner looked honestly bewildered. Bailey watched him. 3 days ago, a spacer was murdered, and the spacers think the murderer is an Earthman. Till now, his finger tapped the desk, nothing's come out.
Is that right?
Commissioner, that's unbelievable.
Jehoshaphat, Commissioner. A thing like this would blow New York off the face of the planet if it really happened.
The commissioner shook his head.
It's not as simple as that. Look, Lige, I've been out 3 days. I've been in conference with the mayor. I've been out to Spacetown. I've been down in Washington talking to the Terrestrial Bureau of Investigation.
Oh? And what do the Terries have to say?
They say it's our baby. It's inside city limits. Spacetown is under New York jurisdiction.
But with extraterritorial rights.
I know. I'm coming to that.
The commissioner's eyes fell away from Bailey's flinty stare. He seemed to regard himself as having been suddenly demoted to the position of Bailey's underling, and Bailey behaved as though he accepted the fact.
The spacers can run the show, said Bailey. Wait a minute, Lige,
pleaded the commissioner. Don't rush me. I'm trying to talk this over, friend to friend. I want you to know my position. I was there when the news broke. I had an appointment with him, with Raj Nemenosartan.
The victim?
The victim, the commissioner groaned. 5 minutes more, and I myself would have discovered the body. What a shock that would have been. As it was brutal. Brutal. They met me and told me. It started a 3-day nightmare, Lige. That, on top of having everything blur on me and having no time to replace my glasses for days. That won't happen again, at least. I've ordered 3 pairs.
Bailey considered the picture he conjured up of the event. He could see the tall, fair figures of the spacers approaching the commissioner with the news and breaking it to him in their unvarnished, emotionless way.
Julius would remove his glasses and polish them. Inevitably, under the impact of the event, he would drop them, then look down at the broken remnants with a quiver of his soft, full lips. Bailey was quite certain that for 5 minutes, anyway, the commissioner was much more disturbed over his glasses than over the murder.
The commissioner was saying, "It's a devil of a position. As you say, the spacers have extraterritorial rights. They can insist on their own investigation, make whatever report they wish to their home governments. The outer worlds could use this as an excuse to pile on indemnity charges. You know how that would sit with the population."
It would be political suicide for the White House to agree to pay.
And another kind of suicide not to pay.
You don't have to draw me a picture, said Bailey. He had been a small boy when the gleaming cruisers from outer space last sent down their soldiers into Washington, New York, and Moscow to collect what they claimed was theirs.
Then, you see, pay or not pay, it's trouble. The only way out is to find the murderer on our own and hand him over to the spacers. It's up to us.
Why not give it to the TBI? Even if it is our jurisdiction from a legalistic viewpoint, there's the question of interstellar relations.
The TBI won't touch it. This is hot, and it's in our lap.
For a moment, he lifted his head and gazed keenly at his subordinate.
And it's not good, Lige. Every one of us stands the chance of being out of a job.
Bailey said, "Replace us all?
Nuts. The trained men to do it with don't exist."
"Ours," said the commissioner. "They exist."
"What?" "Our Sammy is just a beginning. He runs errands. Others can patrol the expressways." "Damn it, man! I know the spacers better than you do. And I know what they're doing. There are ours that can do your work and mine. We can be declassified. Don't think differently. And at our age, to hit the labor pool?"
Bailey said gruffly, "All right." The commissioner looked abashed. "Sorry, Lige." Bailey nodded and tried not to think of his father. The commissioner knew the story, of course. Bailey said, When did all this replacement business come up? Look, you're being naive, Lige. It's been happening all along. It's been happening for 25 years, ever since the spacers came. You know that. It's just beginning to reach higher, that's all. If we muff this case, it's a big, long step toward the point where we can stop looking forward to collecting our pension tab booklets. On the other hand, Lige, if we handle the matter well, it can shove that point far into the future. And it would be a particular break for you. For me? Said Bailey. You'll be the operative in charge, Lige. I don't rate it, Commissioner. I'm a C5, that's all. You want a C6 rating, don't you? Did he? Bailey knew the privileges a C6 rating carried. A seat on the expressway in the rush hour. Not just from 10 to 4. Higher up on the list of choice at the section kitchens. Maybe even a chance at a better apartment and a quota ticket to the solarium levels for Jesse. I want it, he said. Sure, why wouldn't I? But what would I get if I couldn't break the case? Why wouldn't you break it, Lige? The commissioner wheedled. You're a good man. You're one of the best we have. But there are half a dozen men with higher ratings in my department section. Why should they be passed over? Bailey did not say out loud, though his bearing implied it strongly, that the commissioner did not move outside protocol in this fashion except in cases of wild emergency. The commissioner folded his hands. Two reasons. You're not just another detective to me, Lige. We're friends, too. I'm not forgetting we were in college together. Sometimes it may look as though I have forgotten, but that's the fault of rating. I'm commissioner, and you know what that means. But I'm still your friend, and this is a tremendous chance for the right person. I want you to have it. That's one reason, said Bailey without warmth. The second reason is that I think you're my friend. I need a favor. What sort of favor? I want you to take on a spacer partner in this deal. That was the condition the spacers made. They've agreed not to report the murder. They've agreed to leave the investigation in our hands. In return, they insist one of their own agents must be in on the deal, the whole deal. It sounds like they don't trust us altogether. Surely you see their point. If this is mishandled, a number of them will be in trouble with their own governments. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, Lige. I'm willing to believe they mean well. I'm sure they do, Commissioner. That's the trouble with them. The commissioner looked blank at that, but went on. Are you willing to take on a spacer partner, Lige? You're asking that as a favor? Yes. I'm asking you to take the job with all the conditions the spacers have set up. I'll take a spacer partner, Commissioner. Thanks, Lige. He'll have to live with you. Oh, now, hold on! I know. But you've got a large apartment, Lige. 3 rooms. Only 1 child. You can put him up. He'll be no trouble. No trouble at all. And it's necessary. Jesse won't like it. I know that. You tell Jesse. The commissioner was earnest. So earnest that his eyes seemed to bore holes through the glass discs blocking his stare. That if you do this for me, I'll do what I can when this is all over to jump you a grade. C7, Lige. C7. All right, Commissioner. It's a deal. Bailey half rose from his chair, caught the look on Enderby's face, and sat down again. There's something else? Slowly, the Commissioner nodded. One more item. Which is? The name of your partner. What difference does that make? The spacers, said the commissioner, have peculiar ways. The partner they're supplying isn't... Bailey's eyes opened wide. Just a minute. You've got to, Lige. You've got to. There's no way out. Stay at my apartment? A thing like that? As a friend, please, no. Lige, I can't trust anyone else in this. Do I have to spell it out for you? We've got to work with the spacers. We've got to succeed if we're to keep the indemnity ships away from Earth. But we can't succeed just any old way. You'll be partnered with one of their R's. If he breaks the case, if he can report that we're incompetent, we're ruined anyway. We, as a department. You see that, don't you? So you've got a delicate job on your hands. You've got to work with him, but see to it that you solve the case and not he. Understand? You mean cooperate with him 100%? Except that I cut his throat? Pat him on the back with a knife in my hand? What else can we do? There's no other way out. Lige Bailey stood irresolute. I don't know what Jessie will say. I'll talk to her, if you want me to. No, Commissioner. He drew a deep, sighing breath. What's my partner's name? R. Daniel Oliver. Bailey said sadly, This isn't a time for euphemism, Commissioner. I'm taking the job, so let's use his full name. Robot Daniel Oliver. 2. Round trip on an expressway. There was the usual, entirely normal crowd on the expressway, the standees on the lower level and those with seat privileges above. A continuous trickle of humanity filtered off the expressway, across the decelerating strips to local ways, or onto the station areas that led under arches or over bridges into the endless mazes of the city sections. Another trickle, just as continuous, worked inward from the other side, across the accelerating strips and onto the expressway. There were the infinite lights, the luminous walls and ceilings that seemed to drip cool, even phosphorescence. The flashing advertisements screaming for attention. The harsh, steady gleam of the light worms that directed, This way to Jersey sections. Follow arrows to East River Shuttle. Upper level for all ways to Long Island sections. Most of all, there was the noise that was inseparable from life. The sound of millions talking, laughing, coughing, calling, humming, breathing. No directions anywhere to Spacetown, thought Bailey. He stepped from strip to strip with the ease of a lifetime's practice. Children learned to hop the strips as soon as they learned to walk. Bailey scarcely felt the jerk of acceleration as his velocity increased with each step. He was not even aware that he leaned forward against the force. In 30 seconds, he had reached the final 60-mile-an-hour strip and could step aboard the railed and glassed-in moving platform that was the expressway. No directions to Spacetown, he thought. No need for directions. If you've business there, you know the way. If you don't know the way, you've no business there. When Spacetown was first established, some 25 years earlier, there was a strong tendency to make a showplace out of it. The hordes of the city herded in that direction. The spacers put a stop to that. Politely, they were always polite, but without any compromise with tact, they put up a force barrier between themselves and the city. They established a combination immigration service and customs inspection. If you had business, you identified yourself, allowed yourself to be searched, and submitted to a medical examination and a routine disinfection. It gave rise to dissatisfaction. Naturally. More dissatisfaction than it deserved. Enough dissatisfaction to put a serious spoke in the program of modernization. Bailey remembered the barrier riots. He had been part of the mob that had suspended itself from the rails of the expressways, crowded onto the seats in disregard of rating privileges, run recklessly along and across the strips at the risk of a broken body, and remained just outside the Spacetown barrier for 2 days, shouting slogans and destroying city property out of sheer frustration. Bailey could still sing the chants of the time if he put his mind to it. There was Man Was Born on Mother Earth, do you hear? To an old folk tune with the gibberish refrain, Hinky Dinky Parlez-vous. Man was born on Mother Earth, do you hear? Earth's the world that gave him birth, do you hear? Spacer, get you off the face of Mother Earth and into space. Dirty spacer, do you hear? There were hundreds of verses. A few were witty, most were stupid, many were obscene. Everyone, however, ended with, "Dirty spacer, do you hear?" Dirty. Dirty. It was the futile throwing back in the face of the spacers, their most keenly felt insult. Their insistence on considering the natives of Earth as disgustingly diseased. The spacers didn't leave, of course. It wasn't even necessary for them to bring any of their offensive weapons into play. Earth's outmoded fleet had long since learned that it was suicide to venture near any outer world ship. Earth planes that had ventured over the Spacetown area in the very early days of its establishment had simply disappeared. At the most, a shredded wingtip might tumble down to Earth. And no mob could be so maddened as to forget the effect of the sub-etheric hand disruptors used on Earthmen in the wars of a century ago. So the spacers sat behind their barrier, which itself was the product of their own advanced science, and that no method existed on Earth of breaking. They just waited stolidly on the other side of the barrier until the city quieted the mob with somno vapor and wretch gas. The below-level penitentiaries rattled afterward with ringleaders, malcontents, and people who had been picked up simply because they were nearest at hand. After a while, they were all set free. After a proper interval, the spacers eased their restrictions. The barrier was removed and the city police entrusted with the protection of Spacetown's isolation. Most important of all, the medical examination was more unobtrusive. Now, thought Bailey, things might take a reverse trend. If the spacers seriously thought that an Earthman had entered Spacetown and committed murder, the barrier might go up again. It would be bad. He lifted himself onto the expressway platform, made his way through the standees to the tight spiral ramp that led to the upper level, and there sat down. He didn't put his rating ticket in his hatband till they passed the last of the Hudson sections. A C-5 had no seat rights east of the Hudson and west of Long Island. And although there was ample seating available at the moment, one of the way guards would have automatically ousted him. People were increasingly petty about rating privileges, and in all honesty, Bailey lumped himself in with people. The air made the characteristic whistling noise as it frictioned off the curved windshields set up above the back of every seat. It made talking a chore, but it was no bar to thinking when you were used to it. Most Earthmen were medievalists in one way or another. It was an easy thing to be when it meant looking back to a time when Earth was the world and not just one of 50. The misfit one of 50 at that. Bailey's head snapped to the right at the sound of a female shriek. A woman had dropped her handbag. He saw it for an instant, a pastel pink blob against the dull gray of the strips. A passenger hurrying from the expressway must inadvertently have kicked it in the direction of deceleration, and now the owner was whirling away from her property. A corner of Bailey's mouth quirked. She might catch up with it, if she were clever enough to hurry to a strip that moved slower still, and if other feet did not kick it this way or that. He would never know whether she would or not. The scene was half a mile to the rear already. Chances were she wouldn't. It had been calculated that, on the average, something was dropped on the strips every 3 minutes somewhere in the city and not recovered. The lost and found department was a huge proposition. It was just one more complication of modern life. Bailey thought it was simpler once. Everything was simpler. That's what makes medievalists. Medievalism took different forms. To the unimaginative Julius Enderby, it meant the adoption of archaisms, spectacles, windows. To Bailey, it was a study of history, particularly the history of folkways. The city now. New York City, in which he lived and had his being. Larger than any city but Los Angeles. More populous than any but Shanghai. It was only 3 centuries old. To be sure, something had existed in the same geographic area before then that had been called New York City. That primitive gathering of population had existed for 3,000 years, not 300. But it hadn't been a city. There were no cities then. There were just huddles of dwelling places, large and small, open to the air. They were something like the spacer's domes, only much different, of course. These huddles, the largest barely reached 10 million in population, and most never reached 1 million, were scattered all over Earth by the thousands. By modern standards, they had been completely inefficient, economically. Efficiency had been forced on Earth with increasing population. 2 billion people, 3 billion, even 5 billion could be supported by the planet by progressive lowering of the standard of living. When the population reaches 8 billion, however, semi-starvation becomes too much like the real thing. A radical change had to take place in man's culture, particularly when it turned out that the outer worlds, which had merely been Earth's colonies 1,000 years before, were tremendously serious in their immigration restrictions. The radical change had been the gradual formation of the cities over 1,000 years of Earth's history. Efficiency implied bigness. Even in medieval times, that had been realized, perhaps unconsciously. Home industry gave way to factories, and factories to continental industries. Think of the inefficiency of 100,000 houses for 100,000 families as compared with a 100,000 unit section. A book film collection in each house as compared with a section film concentrate. Independent video for each family as compared with video piping systems. For that matter, take the simple folly of endless duplication of kitchens and bathrooms as compared with the thoroughly efficient diners and shower rooms made possible by city culture. More and more the villages, towns, and cities of Earth died and were swallowed by the cities. Even the early prospects of atomic war only slowed the trend. With the invention of the force shield, the trend became a headlong race. City culture meant optimum distribution of food, increasing utilization of yeasts and hydroponics. New York City spread over 2,000 square miles, and at the last census, its population was well over 20 million. There were some 800 cities on Earth. Average population, 10 million. Each city became a semi-autonomous unit, economically all but self-sufficient. It could roof itself in, gird itself about, burrow itself under. It became a steel cave, a tremendous self-contained cave of steel and concrete. It could lay itself out scientifically. At the center was the enormous complex of administrative offices. In careful orientation to one another and to the whole were the large residential sections connected and interlaced by the expressway and the local ways. Toward the outskirts were the factories, the hydroponic plants, the yeast culture vats, the power plants. Through all the melee were the water pipes and sewage ducts, schools, prisons and shops, power lines and communication beams. There was no doubt about it. The city was the culmination of man's mastery over the environment. Not space travel, not the 50 colonized worlds that were now so haughtily independent, but the city. Practically none of Earth's population lived outside the cities. Outside was the wilderness, the open sky that few men could face with anything like equanimity. To be sure, the open space was necessary. It held the water that men must have, the coal and the wood that were the ultimate raw materials for plastics and for the eternally growing yeasts. Petroleum had long since gone, but oil-rich strains of yeast were an adequate substitute. The land between the cities still held the mines, and was still used to a larger extent than most men realized for growing food and grazing stock. It was inefficient, but beef, pork, and grain always found a luxury market and could be used for export purposes. But few humans were required to run the mines and ranches, to exploit the farms and pipe the water, and these supervised at long distance. Robots did the work better and required less. Robots. That was the one huge irony. It was on Earth that the positronic brain was invented, and on Earth that robots had first been put to productive use. Not on the outer worlds. Of course, the outer worlds always acted as though robots had been born of their culture. In a way, of course, the culmination of robot economy had taken place on the outer worlds. Here on Earth, robots had always been restricted to the mines and farmlands. Only in the last quarter century, under the urgings of the spacers, had robots filtered their slow way into the cities. The cities were good. Everyone but the medievalists knew that there was no substitute, no reasonable substitute. The only trouble was that they wouldn't stay good. Earth's population was still rising. Someday, with all that the cities could do, the available calories per person would simply fall below basic subsistence level. It was all the worse because of the existence of the Spacers, the descendants of the early emigrants from Earth, living in luxury on their underpopulated, robot-ridden worlds out in space. They were coolly determined to keep the comfort that grew out of the emptiness of their worlds, and for that purpose they kept their birth rate down and immigrants from teeming Earth out. And this space town coming up. A nudge at Bailey's unconscious warned him that he was approaching the Newark section. If he stayed where he was much longer, he'd find himself speeding southwestward to the Trenton section, turning of the way, through the heart of the warm and musty-odored yeast country. It was a matter of timing. It took so long to shinny down the ramp, so long to squirm through the grunting standees, so long to slip along the railing and out an opening, so long to hop across the decelerating strips. When he was done, he was precisely at the offshooting of the proper stationery. At no time did he time his steps consciously. If he had, he would probably have missed. Bailey found himself in unusual semi-isolation. Only a policeman was with him inside the stationery, and, except for the whirring of the expressway, there was an almost uncomfortable silence. The policeman approached, and Bailey flashed his badge impatiently. The policeman lifted his hand in permission to pass on. The passage narrowed and curved sharply three or four times. That was obviously purposeful. Mobs of Earthmen couldn't gather in it with any degree of comfort, and direct charges were impossible. Bailey was thankful that the arrangements were for him to meet his partner this side of Spacetown. He didn't like the thought of a medical examination any better for its reputed politeness. A spacer was standing at the point where a series of doors marked the openings to the open air and the domes of Spacetown. He was dressed in the Earth fashion, trousers tight at the waist, loose at the ankle, and colors striped down the seam of each leg. He wore an ordinary Textron shirt, open collar, seam zipped, and ruffled at the waist. But he was a spacer. There was something about the way he stood, the way he held his head, the calm and unemotional lines of his broad, high-cheekboned face. The careful set of his short bronze hair lying flatly backward and without a part that marked him off from the native Earthman. Bailey approached woodenly and said, in a monotone, "I am plainclothes man Elijah Bailey, Police Department, City of New York, rating C5. He showed his credentials and went on. "I have been instructed to meet R. Daniil Olivaugh at Spacetown Approachway." He looked at his watch. "I am a little early. May I request the announcement of my presence?" He felt more than a little cold inside. He was used after a fashion to the Earth model robots. The spacer models would be different. He had never met one, but there was nothing more common on Earth than the horrid whispered stories about the tremendous and formidable robots that worked in superhuman fashion on the far-off glittering outer world. He found himself gritting his teeth. The spacer, who had listened politely, said,
"It will not be necessary. I have been waiting for you."
Bailey's hand went up automatically, then dropped. So did his long chin, looking longer in the process. He didn't quite manage to say anything. The words froze. The spacer said,
"I shall introduce myself. I am R. Daniil Olivaugh."
"Yes? Am I making a mistake? I thought the first initial..."
"Quite so. I am a robot. Were you not told?"
"I was told." Bailey put a damp hand to his hair and smoothed it back unnecessarily. Then he held it out. "I'm sorry, Mr. Olivaugh. I don't know what I was thinking of. Good day. I am Elijah Bailey, your partner."
"Good."
The robot's hand closed on his with a smoothly increasing pressure that reached a comfortably friendly peak, then declined.
"Yet I seem to detect disturbance. May I ask that you be frank with me?"
it is best to have as many relevant facts as possible in a relationship such as ours. And it is customary on my world for partners to call one another by the familiar name. I trust that that is not counter to your own customs. It's just, you see, that you don't look like a robot, said Bailey desperately. And that disturbs you? It shouldn't. I suppose Daniel, are they all like you on your world? There are individual differences, Elijah, as with men. Our own robots, well, you can tell they're robots, you understand. You look like a spacer. Oh, I see. You expected a rather crude model and were surprised. Yet it is only logical that our people use a robot of pronounced humanoid characteristics, in this case, if we expected to avoid unpleasantness. Is that not so? It was certainly so. An obvious robot roaming the city would be in quick trouble. Bailey said, yes. Then let us leave now, Elijah. They made their way back to the expressway. R. Daniel caught the purpose of the accelerating strips and maneuvered along them with a quick proficiency. Bailey, who had begun by moderating his speed, ended by hastening it in annoyance. The robot kept pace. He showed no awareness of any difficulty. Bailey wondered if R. Daniel were not deliberately moving slower than he might. He reached the endless cars of expressway and scrambled aboard with what amounted to outright recklessness. The robot followed easily. Bailey was red. He swallowed twice and said, I'll stay down here with you. Down here? The robot, apparently oblivious to both the noise and the rhythmic swaying of the platform, said, is my information wrong? I was told that a rating of C5 entitled one to a seat on the upper level under certain conditions. You're right. I can go up there, but you can't. Why can I not go up with you? It takes a C5, Daniel. I am aware of that. You're not a C5. Talking was difficult. The hiss of frictioning air was louder on the less shielded lower level, and Bailey was understandably anxious to keep his voice low. R. Daniel said, why should I not be a C5? I am your partner and consequently of equal rank. I was given this. From an inner shirt pocket, he produced a rectangular credential card, quite genuine. The name given was Daniel Olivaugh, without the all-important initial. The rating was C5. Come on up, said Bailey woodenly. Bailey looked straight ahead, once seated, angry with himself, very conscious of the robot sitting next to him. He had been caught twice. First, he had not recognized R. Daniel as a robot. Secondly, he had not guessed the logic that demanded R. Daniel be given C5 rating. The trouble was, of course, that he was not the plainclothes man of popular myth. He was not incapable of surprise, imperturbable of appearance, infinite of adaptability, and lightning of mental grasp. He had never supposed he was, but he had never regretted the lack before. What made him regret it was that, to all appearances, R. Daniel Olivaugh was that very myth embodied. He had to be. He was a robot. Bailey began to find excuses for himself. He was accustomed to the robots like R. Sammy at the office. He had expected a creature with a skin of a hard and glossy plastic, nearly dead white in color. He had expected an expression fixed at an unreal level of inane good humor. He had expected jerky, faintly uncertain motions. R. Daniel was none of it. Bailey risked a quick side glance at the robot. R. Daniel turned simultaneously to meet his eye and nod gravely. His lips had moved naturally when he had spoken and did not simply remain parted as those of Earth robots did. There had been glimpses of an articulating tongue. Bailey thought, why does he have to sit there so calmly? This must be something completely new to him. Noise, lights, crowds.
Bailey got up, brushed past R. Daniel, and said, "Follow me." Off the expressway, down the decelerating strips. Bailey thought, "Good Lord. What do I tell Jesse, anyway?" The coming of the robot had rattled that thought out of his head, but it was coming back with sickening urgency now that they were heading down the local way that led into the very jaws of the Lower Bronx section. He said, "This is all one building, you know, Daniel. Everything you see, the whole city. 20 million people live in it. The expressways go continuously, night and day, at 60 miles an hour. There are 250 miles of it altogether, and hundreds of miles of local ways." Any minute now, Bailey thought, I'll be figuring out how many tons of yeast product New York eats per day, and how many cubic feet of water we drink, and how many megawatts of power the atomic piles deliver per hour. Daniel said, "I was informed of this and other similar data in my briefing." Bailey thought, well, that covers the food, drink, and power situation too, I suppose. Why try to impress a robot? They were at East 182nd Street, and in not more than 200 yards, they would be at the elevator banks that fed those steel and concrete layers of apartments that included his own. He was on the point of saying, "This way," when he was stopped by a knot of people gathering outside the brilliantly lighted fourth store of one of the many retail departments that lined the ground levels solidly in this section. He asked of the nearest person in an automatic tone of authority, "What's going on?" The man he addressed, who was standing on tiptoe, said, "Damned if I know. I just got here." Someone else said excitedly, "They got those lousy R's in there. I think maybe they'll throw them out here. Boy, I'd like to take them apart." Bailey looked nervously at Daniil, but if the latter caught the significance of the words or even heard them, he did not show it by any outward sign. Bailey plunged into the crowd. "Let me through! Let me through! Police!" They made way. Bailey caught words behind him. "Take them apart! Nut by nut! Split them down the seams, slow-like!" And someone else laughed. Bailey turned a little cold. The city was the acme of efficiency, but it made demands of its inhabitants. It asked them to live in a tight routine and order their lives under a strict and scientific control. Occasionally, built-up inhibitions exploded. He remembered the barrier riots. Reasons for anti-robot rioting certainly existed. Men who found themselves faced with the prospect of the desperate minimum involved in declassification after half a lifetime of effort could not decide cold-bloodedly that individual robots were not to blame. Individual robots could at least be struck at. One could not strike at something called governmental policy, or at a slogan like higher production with robot labor. The government called it growing pains. It shook its collective head sorrowfully and assured everyone that after a necessary period of adjustment, a new and better life would exist for all. But the medievalist movement expanded along with the declassification process. Men grew desperate, and the border between bitter frustration and wild destruction is sometimes easily crossed. At this moment, minutes could be separating the pent-up hostility of the crowd from a flashing orgy of blood and smash. Bailey writhed his way desperately to the force door. 3. Incident at a shoe counter. The interior of the store was emptier than the street outside. The manager, with commendable foresight, had thrown the force door early in the game, preventing potential troublemakers from entering. It also kept the principals in the argument from leaving, but that was minor. Bailey got through the force door by using his officer's neutralizer. Unexpectedly, he found R. Daniel still behind him. The robot was pocketing a neutralizer of his own, a slim one, smaller and neater than the standard police model. The manager ran to them instantly, talking loudly. "Officers, my clerks have been assigned me by the city. I am perfectly within my rights." There were 3 robots standing rod-like at the rear of the department. 6 humans were standing near the force door. They were all women. "All right now," said Bailey crisply. "What's going on? What's all the fuss about?" One of the women said shrilly, "I came in for shoes. Why can't I have a decent clerk? Ain't I respectable?" Her clothing, especially her hat, were just sufficiently extreme to make it more than a rhetorical question. The angry flush that covered her face masked imperfectly her overdone makeup.
The manager said, I'll wait on her myself if I have to, but I can't wait on all of them, officer. There's nothing wrong with my men. They're registered clerks. I have their spec charts and guarantee slips. Spec charts! Screamed the woman. She laughed shrilly, turning to the rest. Listen to him! He calls them men! What's the matter with you anyway? They ain't men. They're robots! She stretched out the syllables. And I tell you what they do, in case you don't know. They steal jobs from men. That's why the government always protects them. They work for nothing, and on account of that, families gotta live out in the barracks and eat raw yeast mush. Decent, hard-working families. We'd smash up all the robots if I was boss, I tell you that. The others talked confusedly, and there was always the growing rumble from the crowd just beyond the four-store. Bailey was conscious, brutally conscious, of our Daniil Olivaugh standing at his elbow. He looked at the clerks. They were earth-made, and even on that scale, relatively inexpensive models. They were just robots, made to know a few simple things. They would know all the style numbers, their prices, the sizes available in each. They could keep track of stock fluctuations, probably better than humans could, since they would have no outside interests. They could compute the proper orders for the next week. They could measure the customer's foot. In themselves, harmless. As a group, incredibly dangerous. Bailey could sympathize with the woman more deeply than he would have believed possible the day before. No, 2 hours before. He could feel R. Daniil's nearness, and he wondered if R. Daniil could not replace an ordinary plainclothesman C5. He could see the barracks, as he thought that. He could taste the yeast mush. He could remember his father. His father had been a nuclear physicist with a rating that had put him in the top percentile of the city. There had been an accident at the power plant, and his father had borne the blame. He had been declassified. Bailey did not know the details. It had happened when he was a year old. But he remembered the barracks of his childhood, the grinding communal existence, just this side of the edge of bearability. He remembered his mother not at all. She had not survived long. His father, he recalled well, a sodden man, morose and lost, speaking sometimes of the past in hoarse, broken sentences. His father died, still declassified, when Lige was 8. Young Bailey and his 2 older sisters moved into the section orphanage. Children's level, they called it. His mother's brother, Uncle Boris, was himself too poor to prevent that. So it continued hard, and it was hard going through school, with no father-derived status privileges to smooth the way. And now he had to stand in the middle of a growing riot and beat down men and women who, after all, only feared declassification for themselves and those they loved, as he himself did. Tonelessly, he said to the woman who had already spoken, "Let's not have any trouble, lady. The clerks aren't doing you any harm."
"Sure they ain't done me no harm," sopranoed the woman. "They ain't gone either. Think I'll let their cold, greasy fingers touch me? I came in here expecting to get treated like a human being. I'm a citizen. I got a right to have human beings wait on me. And listen, I got 2 kids waiting for supper. They can't go to the section kitchen without me, like they was orphans. I gotta get out of here." "Well now," said Bailey, feeling his temper slipping, "if you had let yourself be waited on, you'd have been out of here by now. You're just making trouble for nothing. Come on now."
"Well!"
The woman registered shock.
"Maybe you think you can talk to me like I was dirt. Maybe it's time the government realized robots ain't the only things on Earth. I'm a hard-working woman, and I've got rights."
She went on and on and on. Bailey felt harassed and caught. The situation was out of hand. Even if the women would consent to be waited on, the waiting crowd was ugly enough for anything. There must be 100 crammed outside the display window now. In the few minutes since the plainclothesman had entered the store, the crowd had doubled. "What is the usual procedure in such a case?" asked R. Daniil Olivaugh suddenly. Bailey nearly jumped. He said, "This is an unusual case in the first place." "What is the law?" "The R's have been duly assigned here. They're registered clerks. There's nothing illegal about that." They were speaking in whispers. Bailey tried to look official and threatening. Alibaugh's expression, as always, meant nothing at all. "In that case," said R. Daniil, "order the woman to let herself be waited on, or to leave." Bailey lifted a corner of his lip briefly. "It's a mob we have to deal with, not a woman. There's nothing to do but call a riot squad." It should not be necessary for citizens to require more than one officer of the law to direct what should be done, said Daniil. He turned his broad face to the store manager. "Open the fourth store, sir." Bailey's arm shot forward to seize R. Daniil's shoulder, swing him about. He arrested the motion. If at this moment two lawmen quarreled openly, it would mean the end of all chance for a peaceful solution. The manager protested, looked at Bailey. Bailey did not meet his eye. R. Daniil said, unmoved, "I order you with the authority of the law." The manager bleated, "I'll hold the city responsible for any damage to the goods or fixtures. I serve notice that I'm doing this under orders." The barrier went down. Men and women crowded in. There was a happy roar from them. They sensed victory. Bailey had heard of similar riots. He had even witnessed one. He had seen robots being lifted by a dozen hands, their heavy, unresisting bodies carried backward from straining arm to straining arm. Men yanked and twisted at the metal mimicry of men. They used hammers, force knives, needle guns. They finally reduced the miserable objects to shredded metal and wire. Expensive positronic brains, the most intricate creation of the human mind, were thrown from hand to hand like footballs and mashed to uselessness in a trifle of time. Then, with the genius of destruction so merrily let loose, the mobs turned on anything else that could be taken apart. The robot clerks could have no knowledge of any of this, but they squealed as the crowd flooded inward and lifted their arms before their faces as though in a primitive effort at hiding. The woman who had started the fuss, frightened at seeing it grow suddenly so far beyond what she had expected, gasped,
"Here now! Here now!"
Her hat was shoved down over her face, and her voice became only a meaningless shrillness. The manager was shrieking,
"Stop them, officer! Stop them!"
R. Daniil spoke. Without apparent effort, his voice was suddenly decibels higher than a human's voice had a right to be. Of course, thought Bailey, for the tenth time, he's not... R. Daniil said,
"The next man who moves will be shot."
Someone well in the back yelled,
"Get him!"
But for a moment, no one moved. R. Daniil stepped nimbly upon a chair and from that to the top of a Trans-Tex display case. The colored fluorescence gleaming through the slits of polarized molecular film turned his cool, smooth face into something unearthly. Unearthly, thought Bailey.